Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utah resorts account for two of the three most expensive ski trips in the U.S. A Utah lawmaker wants less resistance to homeless shelters from neighbors. He hopes stricter rules for service providers help. And regulators say that the Utah beauty industry needs a makeover. Some cosmetologists just want a trim. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Happy New Year, Tom.
Happy New Year. Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV joins us as well. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. And we'll be joined a little later in the hour by reporter Shannon Sollett as well. So let's start with Julie Jagg. I want to talk about this list of the most expensive ski trips. And this would be trips, right? I guess if you live in Utah, if you live in the Salt Lake area, probably, you know, don't have to have lodging, et cetera. It's not as expensive. But who made the list here?
Right. Yeah, it's ski outings. And, you know, we get these every once in a while. But this one was by casino.org. That's who commissioned it. Yeah, I think it's one of those things that they do to kind of get attention, but it definitely got my attention. And so I contacted the researchers and talked to them about what goes into this list. It's pretty eye-opening to see what probably most of these people that came to Park City were paying to spend their holiday here per day. I mean, and obviously, it's like you said, it's less if you live here in Utah, and it's less if you're dividing a lodging out by a family of four or two families or something like that. But it's still pretty eye opening that the resorts were about between $2,600 a day for a day at Deer Valley and $2,538 a day for a day at Park City.
That's per person per day.
Exactly. Yeah. Per person per day. Yep. Yeah. Yikes. It does include, like I said, lodging, which would be divided up probably a little bit more for most people, but does include rentals, a ski rental package, a lift ticket, a half day lesson, a burger, and lodging. I think that was it. A burger and a beer. That's right.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, these are pretty high-end resorts, right? So who in Utah made this list most expensive?
Yeah. So in Utah, we had three. I mean, they only looked at 20 resorts total coming off of the On the Snows list of the best 20 resorts in the United States. And so three from Utah made that list. That was Deer Valley, Park City, and Snowbird. So Deer Valley came in at number two, Park City came in at number three, and Snowbird at number 11.
So who's number one? What's the most expensive resort?
Not a big shocker. It's Aspen Snowmass.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
And some other Colorado resorts made the list as well.
Yeah. Quite a few other Colorado resorts made the list. I'd say it's mostly made up of Colorado. There's Taos Ski Valley in New Mexico as well, Sun Valley, Big Sky, and Jackson Hole. And all the others are Colorado or Utah.
So it's interesting. Deer Valley basically told you, yep, we're expensive and kind of proud of it. That's not their exact words, right? But
well, more or less. Yeah, exactly. Not exact words, but that's basically what they said. Yeah, and that's kind of the Deer Valley brand, right? They definitely cultivate that luxurious brand. And they pride themselves on service and amenities. And those things come at a cost. So if you want to, if you don't mind paying that cost, then you can, that's a good place to go for those things. But on the other hand, you know, Park City basically said they want to keep things less expensive and they're trying to make things less expensive for their guests. But that, you know, didn't show in these results. Part of that is, like I said, lodging, which for both of these was the big chunk. This study said that Park City and Deer Valley both had lodging at about $1,800 a night.
So, yeah, you could knock these prices down by, you know, not staying at their lodges, right? Staying a little out.
Right, exactly. Yep. Staying, in Salt Lake City or farther or something a little bit more economical, or like I said, sharing, with other families or other people, that would knock it down. But one of the interesting things I thought about it was that Park City Resort, this study had their one day ticket prices as $289, but that is only if you bought them ahead of time. If you bought them the day that you wanted to go skiing, which this study took and examined prices on December 27th. And if you bought them at the resort on December 27th at the ticket office there, the ticket price would be $329, I believe. And then once you paid taxes and fees, it would end up being $357.
Now, there's some other resorts on this list, kind of lower down, where the cost seemed a little more reasonable. Like 500 a day, and that's with, if you got the expensive lodging and the ski rentals and everything.
Right, exactly. Yep, the least expensive one on the list was Purgatory Resort, which is dear to my heart since I used to live in Durango, Colorado, and it came in at $485 for a day. So there are definitely cheaper options, and one of the things that people should remember is that I think I saw this in the Colorado Sun, but basically skiing is getting both more expensive and cheaper at the same time. If you plan ahead, or you know in advance that you want to ski this season, and you buy when passes and lift tickets go on sale in April, you're going to get a much better deal than if you wait until the day that you want to go skiing. And also, check out the smaller resorts. I looked at just now at Nordic Valley. Their tickets this weekend are $100 compared to $300, but by next weekend they'll be down to below 50.
Yeah, I was just going to ask. There's I don't know. I don't know if anybody has done an opposite list, right? But the less expensive places, if you look around, you could probably find less expensive places that are probably have pretty good skiing.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Pick a day and just say, okay, how much can you get by with the average prices? This study, looked at, like I said, lodging within half a mile, and kind of averaged out expensive versus cheap places to eat. So that's kind of how they came up with their numbers.
And just like Deer Valley looks at this, I guess there is some prestige to being on this list, most expensive.
So I think some would think so. I think Deer Valley probably thinks so. I think Park City might take a little bit of issue with being ranked so high, but I think also, yeah, that they're the biggest lift served mountain in the US, so they probably think that that's probably worth it as well.
I guess one more thing on this. This does illustrate, I would think, that this is an important part of Utah's economy. This is a lot of money pouring in on the slopes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I mean, all these people that are coming in, paying, lodging fees and taxes, and paying for food, and basically keeping our economy going, especially in the Park City area.
We have a little more time, Julie. I wanted to talk about a story you had a week or so ago. Park City patrollers authorize a strike. And I think they did subsequently go out on strike. I didn't know ski patrollers were unionized, but I guess some of them are.
Yeah.
So
Sorry.
to that would have, and I think that has affected the skiers' experience at some resorts. If you don't have as many ski patrollers up there, that it's going to slow down times, etc.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so in Utah, patrollers are unionized at Solitude and at Park City Mountain. And yeah, at Park City Mountain, they went on strike there a week ago today. So they're now entering their second week of striking. About 200 patrollers went on strike. When they authorized the strike, it was a unanimous vote of about 98.5% of their union members. So pretty strong support for the strike by the members. Seems like the community is also supporting the strike. They're asking for $2 more in starting pay, going up from 21 to 23, and then also kind of lifting the floor for patrollers who have more experience or who have special skills. You know, these are the people who are doing your avalanche, you know, your avalanche safety and clearing hazards and getting up in the middle of the night. So they're looking for a little more pay for the people that have experience with that. And then they're also one of the other main parts of their contract that they're seeking that they haven't come to terms yet with Vail is they're looking for year-round health coverage, so they don't have to seek out new health coverage every 6 months.
Yeah, that one really interested me. You don't think about this, right? You go up there, ski patrollers are there, but it's seasonal work. So if your health care is tied to your job, every 6 months you got to go to a different provider and pay a new deductible.
Exactly. Yep, that's exactly it. And yeah, it's one of those jobs I don't think a lot of us who ski and snowboard really think about too much. You know, we see the people up there with a cross on their jackets. But unless you are hurt, you don't really think about them until they're gone. And that's what Park City is finding out is they brought in, the estimates I've heard is about 30 to 35 replacement patrollers, plus a few patrollers who did not strike. And they're having some troubles. They've said that that has contributed to having less terrain open and slower response times to people that have gotten injured.
So what is, so you've talked about the demands from the ski patrollers. What about management? What about the resorts? I guess they want to keep costs down.
Right. Yep. I think that's exactly it. I think they're a little bit worried about letting the, patrollers tell them what they should be paying. But mostly wanting to keep costs down. And they said that, you know, they feel like they pay a reasonable wage. They said when they had 300 openings for ski patrol, that they have gotten 3,000 applications.
Yeah, I guess it seems a pretty cool job. So I understand there's a GoFundMe site to support the strikers.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, I don't have the address right off the top of my head, but there is a GoFundMe site for the strikers. Last I checked, which was just last night, that it had reached $175,000. So that's, you know, a hefty amount to keep them out there. And we'll see what happens. I believe that the main union office also will start paying the workers $300 a week to if the strike stretches on for a couple weeks.
So this is what, Park City Resort and then a couple of resorts in Colorado being affected here?
Right now it's just Park City Resort. Yeah, okay. Just Park City Mountain. The other unions, a few other unions in Colorado, three others, have expressed solidarity with the union workers, and they have had a picket line in front of Vail Resort's corporate offices, but they have not gone on strike.
So where are we with this? Any progress?
Well, they met again last night and I haven't heard anything. So I'm thinking that they're still working through it. Both sides are working with a mediator. They met three times this week. So I think they're still trying to carve it out, and it's somewhat of a standoff. And unfortunately the guests are the ones that are paying for it. There've been definitely many reports of very long lines and very frustrated people.
I guess just finally, just an overall big picture, a couple of really big snow years last couple of years. This one seems like maybe less snow. It's probably going to affect skiing, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and that's part of what Vail Resorts and Park City Mountain are saying is the problem with the long lines isn't just the patrollers and the lack of train, I should say. It's not just the patrollers. That also the snowpack is down, although this last storm that we've gotten in, then we should get another one on Saturday, will help bring that up. So hopefully that'll help calm things down a little bit and give the people who have been so frustrated a nice ski day before they head home after the weekend.
Well, Salt Lake Tribune Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg, thanks so much for talking about this.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. We'll have Underplayed Stories of the Week at the end of the hour. We're going to head toward a break here, and here's the headline we'll be talking about in the next segment. A Utah lawmaker wants less resistance to homeless shelters from neighbors. He hopes stricter rules for service providers help. We'll have Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV with us. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Here's the headline. A Utah lawmaker wants less resistance to homeless shelters from neighbors. He hopes stricter rules for service providers help. Jose, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Happy to talk about the story.
So, yeah, we're heading into the legislative session coming up just a couple of weeks here. And the lawmaker in question is Representative Tyler Clancy, Republican from Provo. What is he looking to run here?
So he has really taken a big interest in homelessness. He did last session. Looks like he's going to do so again this session. Really on the table is some stricter licensure rules for service providers, nonprofits that run homeless shelters specifically in the state. And he wants to make sure that these service providers are doing as much as they can to halt illegal activity in shelters. Namely, he's really concerned about drug use. He also has some concerns about quality of life crimes. So like when we're talking about quality of life crimes, we're talking about unsanctioned camping, loitering, drug use, et cetera, that are happening outside of the shelters in surrounding neighborhoods. His main push here is that he wants to be able to expand the state shelter capacity. But so far this year, there have been really some high profile fights over where to locate shelters, and that's causing headaches for state officials.
Maybe we could back up and give a little background. You and I have talked about this on this program a little before. He had one big shelter, right, in Salt Lake. And then they decided to break these up into more localized, smaller shelters. But I guess there have been some problems, right? And you got people not wanting these in their backyard.
Definitely. Yeah, that's kind of where Representative Clancy's concerns stem from. With this move from the old Rio Grande shelter in Salt Lake City to these smaller homeless resource centers sprinkled throughout Salt Lake County, sprinkled throughout Salt Lake City and South Salt Lake, he's said that those communities were made promises as to the fact that these shelters wouldn't affect residents' quality of life in those neighborhoods, and he seems to think that those promises aren't being lived up to. So this is kind of his way of remediating that. In terms of the wider system, the state is looking to centralize a lot of its homeless services. They are really discussing right now a new about 1,200 bed shelter that would include more services on site somewhere in the Salt Lake Valley, most likely. So the state's trying to find a new model, and we'll see if that happens and if that works.
So if this larger facility happens, would that replace these smaller shelters?
That's still a little unclear. Basically, there will still be a use for these smaller homeless resource centers, and some of them already host specific populations of people. So there's one shelter for women. For example, those shelters will probably keep doing something similar, where they'll be specifically targeted for a subset of homeless folks, but it's unsure exactly what they will be used for. But that's what people are leaning towards, it seems.
You have a couple of examples in your story, kind of the real life consequences of, a neighborhood not wanting a shelter in that place, And I guess that can limit the places you can put these. One was it Layton? There was a proposed warming center that in the end, the church pulled out.
Yeah. So that was in Fruit Heights. This year, there have been both in Davis and in Weber counties, temporary winter shelter plans have been really hard to pin down. In Davis, there was a church in Fruit Heights that volunteered and said, we can host a temporary winter shelter. Basically, these are spaces that host people when the temperature falls below a certain level. I think it's 15 degrees right now. Those are called code blue nights. And so these aren't, that church wouldn't have hosted folks every day of the week, for all of winter, but on specific nights would have. Later, Davis County officials were able to cobble together three, temporary spaces, throughout the county. But in Weber, they still don't have a winter shelter plan. Not least just because there are fears of public backlash. And that's exactly what happened to this church in Fruit Heights. There was a big meeting and a bunch of folks from that town, came out and said, we don't want this here. We think this is going to, bring crime, as well as other concerns to our community. We don't want this. And so that's kind of one of these problems that Clancy wants to solve. He wants to say, can we clean up these shelters inside and out to make them healthier spaces for the people using them, but also to make it easier to build more of these and keep people from dying on the streets?
So Representative Clancy wants to codify some of this into law. Aren't the shelter providers, don't they already have rules in place that are very similar?
Yeah, so basically the way this works now is that the kind of the operations of individual homeless shelters are actually largely decided at the local level, where local officials work on a process called conditional use permitting with these shelter providers to say, okay, how are you going to serve the people that are staying at your shelter? How are you going to help them move on with their lives? How are you going to keep the neighborhood safe? And they kind of create those stipulations for the service providers. There's also a state licensure process, similar to lots of other fields, that's run through the Office of Homeless Services. And basically what Representative Clancy wants to do is take that state licensure process and codify it into law. That way it's a little bit more concrete. And honestly, he also wants to provide more clarity. One example he gave me was, okay, I want to be able to help service provider staff know when they can handle something internally, right? Maybe not necessarily dangerous behavior, but some unseemly behavior in the shelter. When can you handle that internally versus when do we have to call the police and sort something out? So that's kind of how he wants to move these rules into law.
What are shelter providers saying? They're saying these could, accepting of this? Are they saying there might be problems?
It's a little bit unclear to me at the moment. There, one person that we've talked to a lot about homelessness is, her name is Wendy Garvin, and she runs a relatively small nonprofit called Unsheltered Utah that runs one Code Blue shelter each winter. And she, told me that, actually in this case told KUER, that the shelter staff kind of are overburdened as is, and there aren't enough people working in the shelters to do some of this work. That's a little bit of her fear. And instead she's kind of called for the legislature to just boost funding so that they can basically do their job better, hire more people.
Representative Clancy is working on several things, I think. What else is he looking to work on?
So it seems like there's a big push at the moment to make some more administrative changes. It may be a light session on funding for homelessness. So some lawmakers, including Representative Clancy, are looking to most generally build a more comprehensive homeless services system, break down walls between government agencies. One thing that the Utah Homeless Services Board, which is kind of the board that oversees the Office of Homeless Services, has introduced a pilot in Ogden, a Know Your Name pilot. So basically this whole idea that anyone who's homeless should have an individual caseworker that can connect them to various agencies and services. Right now, it seems like many folks who are on the streets may know various different caseworkers, and those caseworkers might not necessarily connect. So that's one thing that Representative Clancy is working on, is trying to actually expand that Know By Name program. So yeah, there'll be things. This is going to be an interesting session for homelessness.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. I'm sure you will be as well. Jose, I want to talk to you about another related story. Here's the headline. After prolonged delays, long promised Salt Lake City tiny home village for homeless Utahns finally gets its first residence. They had a big ceremony. This is, I guess, is proposed to be a village of tiny homes. I guess my first question, Jose, how tiny?
So these homes are, so in this first batch that opened this week, they're all about 350 square feet. So they've got a little galley kitchen, a small living room space, a bathroom, and a small bedroom. I went in one. It's small, but it's got everything you need. And as one person I talked to said, who's moving in, Paul Eric Fairburn, he said, well, it's a lot better than living on the streets. So there'll be a couple other options for folks in subsequent phases. There may be some slightly smaller options at about 250 square feet. And there should be some slightly larger options at about 400 square feet.
So residents of this, you got to pay some rent. It's lower than you'd pay elsewhere, but what's the rent?
So the rent is about $250 to $500 a month. Those $500 a month units are actually going to be double occupancy units. So you would split that with one of your friends or with your partner, whatever the case may be, theoretically. But you do have to pay rent. Interestingly, all these residents will have gone through a prep school run by the other side village that will have basically prepared them to live in their own space. And that nonprofit organization is affiliated with a bunch of other so-called social enterprises, basically businesses run by nonprofit staff to more or less create job opportunities for these folks who are coming out of homelessness. And so you could theoretically work at one of those enterprises and pay your rent that way as well.
So the city, I think they kicked in the land and some other money?
Yeah, so the city kicked in the land. They basically rent this site of an old landfill to the other side village for, I believe, like $1 a year. And then the state actually kicked in a couple million dollars at least. Into building this project up and getting it off the ground. It doesn't seem like there's going to be much more public funding. We'll see. Last time I talked to the project leaders, they said, we really want to do this through private donations if we can. So we'll see how that works. There's still a lot more units to build. They want to build 430 units. Right now, they're building their first 60. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, 430 units, that'll help. And I think there's like a medical clinic or something proposed as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they really want this to be a full community, right? It's the big opening ceremony on Monday was in this community center that, and for each of this, like even in this small community, there's going to be 9 of these little community centers within it. And then there will be a clinic. There's going to be one of these kind of business spaces where residents could work on site. They're going to have a lot of little things. There's even plans for like an amphitheater. So we'll see about how much of that eventually gets built. But they really want this to be a place where people can feel like they're part of something, that they're part of this community, that they're being, they're living with people who are like them and want the best for them. And so kind of that's a bit of a part of this, is that if you can provide some of these services in this place, maybe people will stick around longer too.
All right, Jose, thanks for telling us about this.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Westside Communities reporter for Salt Lake Tribune, Jose Davila IV. And we'll get his underplayed story of the week at the end of the program. We're going to head toward a break here. When we come back, here's the headline. Regulators say the Utah beauty industry needs a makeover. Some cosmetologists just want a trim. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Shannon Sollett. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this break. This is Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here's the headline we're going to next. Regulators say that the Utah beauty industry needs a makeover. Some cosmetologists just want a trim. We bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Shannon Sollett. Shannon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
So interesting story. I learned a lot, Shannon. I don't frequent beauty salons. But there are a lot of ins and outs to this industry. So I guess there's a lawmaker too that wants to make some changes. What are they proposing?
Yeah, so this is kind of a new process and a new office, and they're starting to review professional licenses every couple of years. This is one of the first. It's kind of on the chopping block. And when I say they, I mean the Department of the Office of Professional License Review, OPLR, and DOPL, and there are all sorts of acronyms that I'm blending right now, but they are the ones who are proposing these changes, and then they're recommending the changes to the legislature. The legislature can choose to use them or not. They will likely draft a bill this session about that is related to the cosmetology license, and they will propose some changes, exactly what those changes are and how closely they mirror Doppel's recommendations, still TBD. But essentially, there are two sort of critical things that Doppel wants to deal with. One is, you know, in their mind, the state's role is to regulate safety and not regulate skill. And right now, the cosmetology license accounts for both of those things. It kind of doubles as a degree or like a certificate that says, hey, I've completed all of these hours, not only of learning and classroom training, but of practice. I've practiced some of these skills for this much time, and I can sort of assert that I'm good at them or good enough. And some in the state think that that's going too far, and that's not really their job. Skill is something that people should, you know, essentially pay to learn themselves or figure out how to learn themselves, or the industry should train for on its own dime. The other issue with the current licensing structure, as Doppel sees it, is that the cosmetology license, the big cosmetology license, takes 1,600 hours of practice, and it includes haircutting, barbering, master esthetician, so skincare, hair removal, all of these things sort of under the umbrella of cosmetology. And some in the state say that there are people who have master cosmetology licenses, but they're still doing something that they didn't really practice for, because the way current cosmetology schools are structured, like, you get a lot of practice cutting hair, you get a lot of practice with certain skills and essentially no practice with other skills. And there's no way to tell if somebody has a cosmetology license what they spent their hours practicing. And so they're trying to just, like, standardize that a little bit and make it easier for consumers to understand. So they're trying to really cut the number of hours required to have the license essentially in half. And then they're also proposing splitting licenses up into micro licenses. So essentially abolishing the master cosmetology license and then letting people have a cosmetology license that is just about hair, an esthetician license, a nail art license, all of these sort of different smaller things.
And I think one of the things they're one of the proposals emphasizes they call them reps, repetitions versus hours.
Yeah. Yeah. They looked at like medical training, for example, and how many hours or how many reps, you're right, how many reps like doctors have to do in certain skills. And in some cases, it's not that many. And they are proposing that that's potentially a more just an easier way to measure how much practice somebody has had in a certain skill and how much they need to be able to practice that skill safely. Because again, that's their main concern, is just with safety.
So I guess one potential problem as they see it is you could get this broad cosmetology license, which also kind of doubles as a degree, right? And then maybe just spend your career doing nails. I guess they see that as a problem.
Yeah. You know, under the current licensing system, like, there, you still can get some micro licenses. You can get a master esthetician license only and not a full cosmetology license. You can just get a nail tech license, but it's not very common. I think that there is incentive for people who are trying to get into the industry to get a full cosmetology license and see if they can sort of transfer their skills and work at, like, bigger salons as needed, you know, where they are needed. But it's true. And an example that came up a couple of times was, like, with tattoo removal, laser tattoo removal, that requires an esthetician and or a cosmetology license. And there's almost no, like, there's not a lot of training for that in any of the current cosmetology schools. So you can have a tattoo removal practitioner who has trained all of these hours in hair and nails and has never really removed a tattoo. but there's no way to tell that based on the license that they have. So I think again, that's one of the things that the state is trying to make easier to understand.
I want to have you follow up and expand on this idea that this license essentially doubles as a degree as well, right, in this industry. Students can get a Pell Grant, for example. They get financial aid for going to cosmetology school.
Yeah. Typically what happens is licensed cosmetologists get these 1,600 hours of requisite practice and training at an accredited cosmetology school. So they graduate essentially from that school with a license. And it says that, you know, I have had all of this training under this specific program and I've trained in these skills. And I think, yeah, Pell Grants are federal funding and they're specifically targeted for students who aren't pursuing like a traditional four-year college education. But it is federal aid and there is a threshold of hours to be eligible for that aid. People currently who just, for example, get a nail tech license already don't meet that threshold because the nail tech micro license is, the hours are pretty small. But anyone who gets a master cosmetology license is eligible. So it's something that the state will have to consider as they're drafting this bill. And it's something that the industry is really worried about losing or even, you know, just like reducing. The fewer hours you are enrolled, the less aid you're eligible for.
So I guess one of the reasons for change, as articulated in your story, would be reduced cost, right? If you just want to do nails, for example, you don't have to get the full 1,600 hours, the full, you know, license. Cost you less money to do that.
That's the idea. That's what the state is arguing. Some people in the industry are worried that it will in fact have the opposite effect, because once you start breaking this industry into all of these different micro licenses, then you're going to have to start paying for each micro license and paying for additional training to sort of get that skill or get that endorsement. And it's just going to sort of snowball, essentially. So instead of paying whatever the tuition is for the entire 1600 hour program, you might pay less technically to get your first license. But then if you actually want to, you know, if you have a hair license, but then you also want to do barbering, or you want to like dye hair, because that's a separate skill than cutting hair, you have to pay for all of those separately and additionally, or you might. And some in the industry are worried that that's just going to add up, and it's going to either, you know, cost students more in the long run, or just keep students out of doing things that they want to do because they can't afford to add that skill to their license.
It's kind of an interesting question, this central question of the state is saying we just need to license people so they can be around people safely. Industry, some salon owners are saying, well, you know, you want skill. State's saying, though, you know, skill's not our problem. I guess as a customer, skill is a problem, right? I want to you know, have somebody skillful cutting my hair or whatever, especially removing a tattoo, I guess. So I guess that's how are they going to bridge those two?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of one of the cruxes, I think, of this conversation. And, you know, there are people, like, I think some people currently in the industry are worried that what's going to happen is that if Doppel's recommendations make it into this bill, and if that's the version that we get and that passes, the new licensing system could just, like, sure, it will create more licensed cosmetologists, but those cosmetologists will not have any employable skills once they have that license. And what are salons supposed to do about that, right? So they will be, you know, graduating from these schools with license in hand, but who's going to hire them, and who's going to want to pay them to do their hair or to remove their tattoos or to do any of these things that we are expecting a pretty high level of skill for? I think you're right. But then there are other people in the industry who've been in the industry for decades who are saying, listen, we already do that. We are, like, any salon is going to train a newly graduated and a newly licensed person. The burden already falls on us. We budget the X amount of dollars for training every year. And there are some who think that this might actually help, because it, again, it lets students be more specific in what they study, and it lets them specialize a little bit more in the skills that they build. So there are some who think that that will just be an advantage. Really hard to say now, sitting here, how that will play out, but it is a big question that lawmakers are going to have to at least consider as they draft this bill.
So who's going to run this bill, do we think?
Right now it's in the interim Business and Labor Committee, and the sponsor is, I think, I've been told, Senator Sandel. And he didn't talk to me for the story. I talked to someone else on the committee who said that, Senator Todd Weiler, who said that, yeah, he is hearing a lot of industry concerns about Doppler's proposal, specifically Doppler's proposal, and he hopes that he and his colleagues can take them into account. I haven't, as of publication time, there wasn't a draft of the bill to see, so I don't know. I don't know what it will look like. I don't know how closely it will mirror Doppler's recommendations. We'll see.
Speaking of Senator Weiler, it's interesting in your story. He says we need to he says it, beware of unintended consequences, I think. Not his exact words, maybe, because his wife's in the industry and his daughter's training for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So he has some personal stake, and he was very careful to say, like, I know I don't represent my wife or my daughter, or represent the entire state of Utah, but I just want to make sure that that we are considering all of the concerns that we are hearing, and, you know, some of the support that they're hearing for these proposals.
It's interesting. I guess one more thing on this, Shannon. You talked with some salon owners. In fact, you kind of spent some time with one specific owner, Lauren Spatifiore. She runs a Lunatic Fringe franchise. Yeah. Tell me just a little bit about that. What the scene is there in a salon like that?
I mean, yeah, it's very hip. I think there is, like, in my mind, as someone who does spend a decent amount of time in beauty salons, you know, I think there are tiers of salon. There is, like, the great clips, the sort of mall haircut. They do, like, hundreds of people a day. And then there are places like Lauren's. Hers is technically a franchise, but she owns her store. It's big. It's roomy. It's very hip. It feels just, like, very chic and young and energetic in there. I think she has around 30 stylists at any given time. There are separate rooms. There's, like, a color processing room, so people can sort of wait for their color to process in peace and silence, and off of the main floor where everyone else is getting their hair dried and cut and shaped. And it's almost, the industry at large is almost all women. It's like 95% women. Lauren has, you know, she says that she's really taken it upon herself to train all of her stylists and just sort of set them up for success, both, like, skill-wise and financially. She worked her way up from, you know, a single mom living in her parents' basement with her kid to a six-figure stylist in, like, 3 years. And then she owned her own salon. And that, in her mind, like, that is the power of cosmetology. Cosmetology is her passion, but it's also, like, a pathway to financial freedom for a lot of women. And she's trying to just, like, facilitate that in her salon and with her stylists. And it's a cool energy to be a part of, or to witness.
Well, thanks for telling us about this. Very interesting story. We'll see what happens at the legislature. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Shannon Sollett. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week. And we'll start with outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. What's your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, I wanted to give a shout out to Clarissa Casper. She wrote about the lack of recreation facilities in Cache County and the struggle that the county is having, or the people in the county, I should say, are having in getting one built. And they basically have no place to go inside and do recreation except for the schools during the winter. So, yeah, I think that's a really interesting story.
Yeah, I got a personal stake in this. Where do I play tennis during the winter? So, yeah.
There you go.
I'm here in Cache Valley. Thanks, Clarissa Casper, a UPR reporter along with Salt Lake Tribune reporter. Jose Dávila IV, what's your underplayed story of the week?
I really enjoyed Jordan Miller's profile of Cindy Gus Jensen, who even the mayor called the most powerful person in City Hall. She is the executive director of the Salt Lake City Council. So she's basically the leader of all of the staff who work for the council. So, like, research staff, policy staff. And so it was just a really awesome profile of somebody who's worked at the city for 40 years and is finally retiring this month. It was super fun to read. And I love profiles of, like, the public servants we never think about, but nonetheless, like, shape so much of our city's landscapes.
Yeah, thanks. Check that out at sltrib.com, as well as all these stories. So Shannon Sollett, what's your underplayed story?
My underplayed story is from Courtney Tanner. She wrote a really interesting story about how the U is looking into a medical humanities degree. And the idea is that, like, studying the humanities, studying arts and history and literature makes people, like, more well-rounded and therefore will make better doctors. And that would include things like bioethics and art in medicine. And I just think that that's such an interesting concept to even explore. It also comes at a time where, like, universities are facing some tightening belts and some potential budget cuts, and the humanities specifically are kind of on the chopping block. And, like, speaking of existential conversations, I think there's a really big one now happening about humanities and about the value of humanities. And it's really, I just think it's fascinating to see it tied into something like medicine, which I think is so, like, no one really questions the value of medical education. So I just think it's really cool.
Yeah. Interesting story. You can find that at sltrib.com as well. Well, you've reached the end of our hour. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We've had with us outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Julie, thanks.
Thanks for having me, Tom, as always.
Thank you. Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV has been with us. Jose, thanks.
Thanks so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And reporter Shannon Solid has been with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. And yes, Happy New Year to everybody. And I hope you'll join us again this time next week for Behind the Headlines. Thanks, everyone.